great thing about the internet is it disintermediates the message. You know, people will now go to the website, make up their own minds. They don't need a professional leftist TV journalist standing in front of the camera with a microphone telling them what they ought to think about something.
Hi, I'm Michael Moynihan for Reason TV, and I'm here today with MEP Daniel Hannan of Southeast England and internet superstar. I think you're a superstar at this point. 2.5 million views of your great denunciation of Gordon Brown in European Parliament. Tell us a little bit. Was this a total shock to you? Out of nowhere, you... And give us a general idea of what your denunciation of Gordon Brown was.
Well, I tried to say to him what I figured my constituents would want to say to him if they were there, which is that he's spending all their money and there's nothing to show for it. I was completely flabbergasted by the way it took off. I still don't really understand why. It may have been that it was a three-minute speech, which is a kind of good YouTube length. It's about the average length of a pop video. Maybe, I don't know. It may simply have been that it was a surrogate way of giving the guy a bit of a slapping for all the people who would have liked to have done it themselves. The amazing thing is it shows that nobody can predict what the public is going to like. Great thing about the internet is it disintermediates the message. You know, people will now go to the website, make up their own minds. They don't need a professional leftist TV journalist standing in front of the camera with a microphone telling them what they ought to think about something.
This stuff resonates, obviously, with the American right and the American libertarian right. Who are your political influences? I've seen you reference Ron Paul. I believe you've referenced Hayek and Friedman on your blog. Tell us a little bit.
Yeah, all of those guys, right? Take the rest as read, you know, and Ayn Rand and yada yada. In a British context, Enoch Powell. You know, he was somebody who understood the importance of national democracy, who understood why you needed to live in an independent country and what that meant, as well as being a free marketeer and a small government conservative. But going a bit further back, some of the patriot leaders who founded the U.S. On British political principles, although those principles were subsequently lost in Britain. But the Jeffersons and the Adams and the Washingtons. The idea of a executive constrained by a legislature, of laws only being passed with popular consent, of taxes not being raised except by elected legislators, those were the ideals that have done most to keep mankind prosperous and happy and free.
You have a book called The Plan, and it is a plan for what? And what are the sort of main sort of tenets of the plan?
One way of putting it is that it is an application of Jeffersonian principles to UK political conditions. So we are pushing for the ideal that decisions should be taken as closely as possible to the people that they affect, decision makers should be accountable through the ballot box, and the citizen should be as free as possible from state coercion. That sounds very easy, very banal. When you translate it into policy in a British context, it becomes incredibly radical. It means we would have elected sheriffs, local sales tax, dispersal of power, self-financing local authorities, referendums and initiative procedures, a shift in power from the government to parliament. A lot of things which you would take for granted in North America and, you know, which are often, in a British context, attacked as my attempt to Americanize Britain. They say, oh, you know, you're copying all these things of states' rights and the sheriffs and so on. To which my answer is, you know, where did they get those ideas from, the patriot leaders of the 18th century? You know, they didn't see themselves as radicals at the time. They saw themselves as conservatives. In their own minds, when they took up arms, they were fighting to defend what they had always assumed to be their birthright as freeborn British subjects. And the innovators, as they saw it, were those in the Hanoverian court who were trying to suck power away from parliaments and into the executive. So we're in this strange situation where we exported the tradition of British freedom to this part of the world, where it thrived, but in the mother country, it's withered. And so I desperately want us to bring back, to repatriate our revolution and bring back the principles that have served to keep this country free back to the place where they originated.
So currently you're trying to bring, and again, this is your critics saying Americanization, which is obviously a dirty word, in more of an American direction where we have a government that is desperately trying to bring us more in a European direction. So I suspect the question that you're getting quite a bit these days are questions about the NHS. What has your experience been with the British system? What would you warn people away from this? Would you tell them to embrace it? What's your general take?
I would warn people away because when you see a friend about to make a mistake, you tell him. You know, you don't let him walk into making the same mistake that you made. Look, this isn't just my opinion. You will always have anecdotal stories about people having a wonderful experience or a terrible experience. What you need to do is try and be as empirical as you can about this. Look at the actual data. You know, would you rather be ill in the US system or in the UK system? And the answer, if you look at survival rates for cancer or stroke or heart disease, that is unquestionably that you would be better off in the US. That's just fact. Now, some of people watching this may have seen that extraordinary film where Michael Moore kind of goes waddling around saying, oh, but, you know, mortality is better in the UK, life expectancy is longer. That's probably true overall, right? Life expectancy is longer in the UK because we have less teenage crime and this kind of thing. But the relevant question in terms of healthcare is, what is your life expectancy from the moment that you are diagnosed with one of these conditions? And the answer is, it is far worse in the UK than in the US, but than in other countries that have a kind of mixed system. For the most obvious reason, which is that the government runs things badly. It is no more competent at running hospitals than it was at building cars or operating airlines or installing telephones. The state is not a good manager.
And this is something you guys have dealt with for many years. I mean, I always reference back to reference the Yes Minister episode where there's opening a hospital and they said, we don't need any patients. We need a hospital. We need a place to employ people. We don't actually have to treat anyone here.
And it's the perfect hospital because it's clean. Nobody dies there because there are no patients. Yeah. You know, like so many things in that Yes Minister series, it was eerily prophetic. The NHS now employs 1.4 million staff, of whom a majority are administrators. Right? The bureaucrats, the managers, outnumber the doctors and nurses within that 1.4 million. And that's what makes it such a difficult system to get rid of, because you then have this huge block of people who have a vested interest in the status quo. And that's why I would say to Americans watching this, think hard before you start down this road. Don't imagine that you can experimentally bring in a government option and then if it doesn't work out, you can just reverse it. That isn't our experience. It will grow and grow. It will start sucking in more and more taxpayers' money. It becomes politically impossible to deny demands for greater resources, and in the end it squeezes to the very fringes any private alternatives, so that you end up in a situation like in Britain where there is private insurance for the very, very wealthy, for a tiny number of people who can afford to buy their way out of the NHS, even though they've already obviously paid for it in their taxes. But it's such a tiny market that there isn't really any proper competition within it, and therefore 90%+ of the population are left dependent on a state system which, you know, contains good people and where you can sometimes have good experiences because there are kindly and dedicated doctors and nurses in it, but where overall it is not nearly as good a system as it would be if we had the kind of consumer choice, the opportunity for redress that you have in your system.
David Cameron, it is polling numbers now are, I mean, overwhelmingly favoring the Tories for the first time in a very long time. What do you think that the American right can learn from David Cameron? He has sort of lunged towards the center in a lot of ways. How are these new Tories, in your estimation, is there any vestige of sort of Thatcherism left in these people? And is there something that we as Americans, or the American right, which is floundering right now against Barack Obama, can learn from David Cameron?
I think there are things the American right can learn. It's a gross oversimplification to say that he has lunged towards the center. In some ways, he has been much more radical than any previous conservative leader, including Margaret Thatcher, not least on this agenda of democratization and decentralization of power. He's gone further on those things, elected sheriffs and local sales tax and so on, than any previous leader. What would you learn? I'd say this. Look, if you're a conservative, it is very easy to be negative, because the world is not the way we would like it. Heaven knows that there are lots of things to complain about, and we complain, you know. And in a way, we're right to complain, but we come across very easily as curmudgeonly if all we do is complain. And the lesson, you could take it from Cameron, or you could take it from Reagan in a domestic context, is that to be a successful conservative, you also have to imbue your vision with a little breath of warmth. You have to convey a sense of optimism, that you don't just criticize what's wrong, although heaven knows there is plenty to criticize. You also posit a vision of what could be better. You give the voters a sense that there is a better tomorrow, and that if they vote for you, there will be tangible and immediate consequences that will improve their lives. And if you can do that, rather than being the angry old man, I find myself doing it sometimes. You know, I was doing it when the Prime Minister came to Brussels. If you could do that, then people come with you.
Daniel Hannan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Michael Moynihan with Reason TV, and thank you for watching.